from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In what may be a preview of national elections later this year, preliminary results from Spain's regional elections Sunday showed big gains for the upstart leftist movement Podemos, as well as for some center-right parties, with the conservative People's Party losing their majority. With more than 90% of the votes counted, the ruling PP appears to have retained a plurality, although it appears that it will now face coalition politics. In one example, the PP managed to win 21 of the 57 seats in the Madrid City Council, while 20 seats went to a coalition of left-wing movements, including Podemos. The Socialist Party, or PSOE, won 9 seats in the Assembly. The results might be the worst for Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy's party in more than 20 years, as many of the voters, suffering from severe austerity imposed by his government and following a series of corruption scandals in the country, turned to either the right-wing Ciudadanos and anti-austerity Podemos. In Barcelona, another Podemos-backed movement, headed by social activist Ada Colau, gained 11 seats in the local parliament, beating parties that called for Catalonia's independence from Spain. Colau has promised a drastic reduction in perks for local members of parliament and an emergency plan against poverty. Talks on nuclear nonproliferation at the United Nations in New York ended without an agreement last week. The 2015 review conference of the parties to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, known as the NPT, failed to reach a consensus on how to achieve a Middle East zone free of nuclear weapons and all other weapons of mass destruction. That conference took place 20 years after the adoption of the 1995 resolution on the Middle East, which called for the creation of a zone free of all nuclear weapons. We begin with this report from Daniel Dickinson at the United Nations.
The NPT is a landmark international treaty whose objective is to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and weapons technology. Conferences to review the operation of the treaty have been held at 5-year intervals since it went into effect in 1970. It was hoped the 2015 meeting would reach what the UN Secretary-General called a new collective vision on how to achieve a Middle East zone free of nuclear weapons. Ban Ki-moon said he was disappointed that UN member states were unable to reach an agreement. He said he was ready to support efforts to promote and sustain the inclusive regional dialogue necessary to reach a deal in the Middle East. More than 150 countries took part in the month-long NPT conference. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
For more on this, we have this report from Press TV's Hassan Abedi.
In recent months, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu caused the relations between Israel and the U.S. to plunge to their lowest level in decades. That's mainly because of his firm opposition to any nuclear deal between the P5+1 and Iran. Netanyahu has even been lobbying Republican lawmakers behind Obama's back and is doing his best to sabotage the ongoing talks between Iran and the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. Meanwhile, Israel's rejection of a U.S.-backed two-state solution to the conflict with Palestine in March further raised tensions with Washington. American diplomats have warned Tel Aviv that Washington could halt its support for Israel at the UN if it presses ahead with its policies. But that stance failed a major test on the final day of a conference in New York, which was held to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The conference ended in failure after the U.S. blocked the proposed ban on nukes in the Middle East as a favor to nuclear-armed Israel. More than 150 countries took part in the month-long event, which needed a consensus to adopt a decision.
The United States has never acted in any respect for a nuclear-free area in the Middle East. They have facilitated, they have supported, they have expanded the Israeli nuclear arsenal from its beginning until this very moment.
Tel Aviv was quick to appreciate the move. The Israeli premier conveyed his gratitude to Obama in a phone conversation with Secretary of State John Kerry. Tel Aviv also thanked Britain and Canada for joining America in preventing a resolution at the New York conference. Meanwhile, an Israeli official has said that Washington kept its commitment to Tel Aviv by resisting the ban. Israel is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the Middle East and is widely believed to have hundreds of warheads in its arsenal. Its nukes have been described as the key destabilizing source in the Middle East, but the U.S. is unwilling to listen to criticism of Israel. At the same time, Washington keeps pressuring Iran, which is a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and has cooperated with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Observers believe that's because Iran isn't in the circle of U.S. allies in the region and opposes its policies. The U.S. double standards over the past decades have emboldened Israel to the extent that, at times, it even defies its own staunch allies.
We'll have more on that tomorrow. The aid ship bound for Yemen that carried a group of international peace activists with food and medical aid for the people of that war-torn country was forced to port in Djibouti, Somalia, where the aid was handed over to the U.N. That move came after U.S.-backed Saudi forces launched air attacks on the port they were headed to in Yemen and amid threats on the lives of the aid bearers. U.S. activist Caleb Maupin from the International Action Center was on board. He spoke with us from the airport at Istanbul early Sunday.
We proceeded through the Gulf of Aden, and we were proceeding to our destination, which was Hodeidah. We got very close, and as on the day we were expected to arrive, the Saudi military bombed the port of Hodeidah, not once, not twice, but eight times in a single day they bombed the port of Hodeidah. And then the resistance forces in Yemen arrested 15 people. These were Sudanese mercenaries who had positioned themselves all around the port with rocket launchers, and they were going to fire rocket launchers and destroy the boat upon our arrival. So in that context, there were negotiations going on around the clock in Tehran, and in that context, the Red Cross decided that we would go to Djibouti. We then went to Djibouti, and they wouldn't allow us to port in Djibouti for at least 2 days. And so outside of Djibouti, we stayed on the ship for 2 days and waited to dock before they let us port in Djibouti. It was very unfortunate that the Saudis basically used terrorism to prevent us from arriving. They made clear that if we had ported and docked in Hodeidah and begun to deliver this medical aid, they were going to kill us. And they probably killed, we don't know the exact number yet, but a number of dock workers and other people who worked in Hodeidah simply for being at the port that we intended to go to. Which is really, really horrendous. I mean, the Saudi military, and the Saudi regime has really committed a crime against humanity and basically, threatening the lives of a boat full of doctors, medical technicians, and other Red Cross volunteers who are trying to bring humanitarian aid to people who are in need.
You know, not to pull privilege or anything, but the Saudis are U.S. allies and you're carrying a U.S. passport. You're a U.S. citizen. Did you try to reach out to the U.S. embassy to ask them to intervene with the Saudis?
Well, that didn't occur to me at all. I made no effort to reach out to the U.S. because I know that these attacks that were done on the port of Hodeidah and done, attempting to attack the vessel I was on, they were probably done with the permission of the U.S. government. Very little is done by the Saudi government without the permission of the United States. I'll tell you, when I was on that ship and I saw that the Iran Shahid and our rescue ship journey was getting a lot of publicity in the U.S. media, there were times I had a moment where I was thinking, and I thought, especially after I heard that the representative of the Pentagon, Mr. Warren, had made a statement about the ship saying that we should go to Djibouti, we should not complete our mission. It occurred to me that they probably were having a meeting somewhere in the Pentagon, and they were probably looking to see who was on that ship. And they probably learned through their intelligence that there was an American or someone from the United States on the ship. And they probably pulled up my picture in a Pentagon room and said, could we kill this guy? Should we kill this guy? Would that be okay? Right. And they probably had a discussion about whether or not I should continue living. And that was a very eerie thought to have, that my own government was basically weighing the pluses and minuses of taking my life. And it's important, to be clear that if we had continued our mission, if we had arrived on schedule in Hodeidah, I would be dead right now. I would not be alive any longer. They would have opened up on our ship with rocket launchers, and the port of Hodeidah would have been bombed, and I would not have survived, and neither would any of the other people on the vessel. I came very close to dying on this trip, and that's something that I'm kind of processing. I haven't thought about it too much because I really don't know how to react, but it's something I'm kind of processing as I'm back in Iran, back among friends, and safe.
Yeah, that's kind of a scary thought. So you didn't feel essentially that the U.S. Embassy was a place to go for protection?
No, I didn't. And I will say, you know, there was a scary, you know, leaving Djibouti and heading to Iran was quite a frightening experience because we saw Blackwater employees monitoring the Iranian ship. You know, I'll have to tell that story later, maybe when I return, knowing that the Blackwater was watching our ship and that, you know, that we were being monitored. And Djibouti is very much a nest of U.S. spies, U.S. military forces. And, you know, when I was in Djibouti, I really could see the difference between a country that's broken free from imperialism and begun to develop like Iran and a country that's still under the clutches of the Western bankers. Because Djibouti, I mean, that's one of the most strategic locations. Every Western country, every major Western power docks and uses the port of Djibouti. You know, whether it's the U.S., Germany, France, Spain, they all have used that. That port is very strategic. But yet the people of Djibouti are not seeing any benefit from living in such a strategic location. Djibouti is full of desperate, starving people who are just lined up outside the port to get work. You know, I mean, Djibouti is a very, very important place. It's a very wealthy place, you could say. But the people of Djibouti are greatly, greatly impoverished. But the people of Djibouti that we spoke to, so many of the port workers in the port in Djibouti really had a positive feeling about Iran. Even though the Djibouti government is aligned with the United States, so many port workers came to the Iran Shahid and shouted things like, you know, Allahu Akbar, and, you know, raised their fists and told us that they thought that the Iranians were great, that they were fighting the Israelis and fighting against the United States. The port workers in Djibouti were absolutely pro-Iranian. I mean, these are just the people who work every day unloading ships, and they, you know, they had a really pro-Iran feeling. One of the cab drivers in Djibouti was telling me that you know, that there's a possibility of a Chinese port opening up, a Chinese-controlled port opening up in Djibouti, and the current president is having those discussions. And based on that, they don't know how much longer he will last. They think that the U.S. and others will arrange for him to be removed because he's too open to friendship with China. And that's one thing I've noticed all throughout this trip is the influence, the rising influence of China on the world markets. I was in Bandar Abbas, which is the port we departed from in Iran. And in Bandar Abbas, you know, there's a whole city there that has just sprung up within the last 3 years. And it's mainly because of Chinese investment in the Iranian ports. You know, China is the wild card. You know, the U.S. thinks it can control the world, but there's a whole nother center of power in the world economy that's developing with China, Russia, Venezuela, Bolivia, all these countries that, you know, some of them may be nationalistic, some of them may be led by communist parties, others may be led by Bolivarian socialists, others may be led by, you know, like in Iran, it's an Islamic republic, but all of them reject Western neoliberal capitalism and argue that you need heavy state control of the economy and that the priority should be given to human needs and not profits. And this block of countries is really emerging very strongly. And, you know, the U.S. is trying to suppress that. In Syria, you know, so much money has gone to support these insurgents that are just tearing up the country. And, you know, in Ukraine, they overturned a government that was more sympathetic to Russia. And now the country has been drowned in civil war. And even in Iran, there are terrorist groups funded by the United States that assassinate people and do things. But really, I mean, this emerging block of countries that are free from kind of Wall Street economic domination, it's really unstoppable. As much as the United States would like to stop it with military power, this new block of kind of anti-imperialist resistance is really the rising hope for humanity at this moment.
And finally, what do you think are the prospects for the next aid ship to or aid shipment to Yemen?
I know that there has been – they haven't given up. Let me put it that way. The Red Crescent Society of Iran has not given up. They want to continue trying to bring aid to the people of Yemen. So plans are being made. People are going to continue trying to break this blockade. The Saudis should not be allowed to continue their crime against humanity. Blocking humanitarian assistance to people who are in need is a crime against humanity. It's a violation of international law. And the world is not going to sit by and allow the Saudis to continue it. And that's all there is to it. The people are going to continue to resist. I also want to say that I was in the Istanbul airport, and I bought a copy of the Financial Times because I wanted to catch up on the news, the British newspaper, the Financial Times. And I turned in the newspaper, and lo and behold, there was an article about the ship, the Iran Shahid. And the article mentioned the ship that I was on with a whole bunch of Red Crescent Society volunteers and other peace activists to try and bring aid to the people in Yemen. And it mentions, it has about two paragraphs about this ship. And then the rest of it was all, these kind of rumors that Iran might be sending weapons to resistance forces in Yemen. And it really disappointed me because it appeared that if you read the article, the implication was to try and say that what I engaged in was somehow a military operation, that this ship that I was on was somehow a military thing. We were trying to send weapons to the Houthi Ansarullah organization or something like that. And that really disappointed me and disturbed me because, I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. This was a purely peaceful humanitarian mission. We agreed to be inspected by the United Nations and the International Red Cross. The ship has been unloaded by the International Red Cross and the World Food Program. There were no weapons or any military hardware of any kind on this ship. This was purely a humanitarian mission. There was flour, medicine. I looked into a number of the cargo parts of the boat. I mean, this was a purely humanitarian mission about helping those in need. And the Saudis blocked it with terrorism. They blocked it with bombing the ports, with setting up a plot to attack the ship, killing people. People were killed to prevent this ship from arriving. And that narrative of what happened really needs to get to the people of the world. The people of the world need to know that the Saudis weren't blocking a delivery of weapons. They were blocking a delivery of food and water and medical supplies to people in Yemen who are in desperate need because of a vicious U.S.-backed Saudi bombing campaign that has killed thousands and thousands of innocent civilians.
A group of several dozen women's peace activists, including two Nobel Peace Prize laureates, crossed the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea to draw attention to the state of war that has persisted on the peninsula since the early 1950s and to call attention to the need for engagement and peace. Frank Smith reports from the DMZ.
Arriving on a bus from North Korea, women's activist Gloria Steinem led 30 female colleagues, including two Nobel laureates, into South Korea. Her group hoped to break down the barrier they had just crossed.
We can learn on paper and on screen, but the ability to understand, not just learn, happens when we are together and able to empathize. We were able to have conversations with women who are counterparts, and to do that without any official function whatsoever.
The Korean War has not officially ended, the group pointed out, emphasizing their promotion of a peace treaty.
To think that we came here to end the war, I think this is the first step in the right direction, and we firmly believe that every little step is the right step in the right direction.
Some supporters in Women Cross the DMZ wished it could be them instead of Steinem and other foreigners that could freely travel between the two states.
Honestly, I feel a little sad because we cannot cross the DMZ because we are Korean. That's ridiculous, right? So someday I want to close DMZ for peace, Korean.
Marching along the border with North Korea, the women hoped to quell the controversy their visit had stirred in South Korea, where the Steinem trip was not so popular. The Women Cross the DMZ event had originally planned to enter South Korea from the north through the peace village of Panmunjom, where the Korean War armistice was signed in 1953. However, that plan was scuttled due to Washington and Seoul's objections to the entire endeavor. Following their march, the group attended a concert at a peace park near the DMZ and planned Monday to take part in a women's peace forum in Seoul. Frank Smith, Press TV, from the Demilitarized Zone.
The inclusion of Gloria Steinem in the group raised questions of CIA involvement in the action. Steinem herself has admitted that she once worked for the agency.
Gloria, at the festival, you worked for the Independent Research Service.
That's right.
Well, Exactly when did your own association with the CIA start, and in what fashion? Did they come to you, or did you go to them?
In 1958, when I came home from India, I discussed with student leaders, past and present, many of them active with the National Student Association, this kind of small foundation to encourage Americans to go. They thought it was a good idea, too. I was then told by foundations and professors and friends that I should not do this, that I would get in trouble with the House Un-American Activities Committee, the American Legion, all of those 50s people. And I became convinced that it was impossible. It was at that point that the student leaders said to me that they had in the past received funds for international programs from the CIA, and that they felt that this was important and could also be partly funded by the CIA.
Well, I mean, did you feel that you really tried? I mean, did you go around to all of the wealthy private foundations, wealthy private people, and explain your point of view and explain why you felt it was important that the United States be represented at these things in a certain way? What did they tell you?
They told me that, well, the Ford Foundation, for instance, told me that they thought we were too liberal and too controversial, and that we would endanger their cultural programs in Austria. I mean, the first festival was being held in Vienna. It was not encouraging at all. And the private individuals to whom I went often had particular points of view to put forward, which would have been much, much more restricting than the CIA funds were, which were free. I mean, no one was told what to say.
You mean they were free? You mean to say it was easier for you to work for the CIA than a private organization?
That's right. That's right. And the reason I think that comes as a surprise, as it did to me at the time. I mean, I had the conventional liberals' view of the CIA as a right-wing incendiary group. And I was amazed to discover that this was far from the case, that they were enlightened, liberal, nonpartisan activists of the sort who characterized the Kennedy administration, for instance.
You have not been working now for the CIA since 1962.
Mm-hmm.
You still criticize. You were down recently in Washington.
Yes, when the story broke that I had once been, that I have for 4 years been a Central Intelligence agent, I was demonstrating outside the Pentagon underneath Mr. McNamara's office against bombing in Vietnam. And this didn't precisely fit with the image of a CIA agent, but then neither does the CIA.
As we reported last week, a top CIA official told CNN that he believed a U.S. war with China was a real possibility. Now another prominent voice in the U.S. has raised that concern, billionaire George Soros. In an article published Friday by the Russian news agency Sputnik, Soros was quoted as saying that, quote, there is a real danger that China will align itself with Russia politically and militarily, and then the threat of the Third World War becomes real, closed quote. He called for the U.S. to bind China to the Western-dominated global system by allowing Chinese currency to join the International Monetary Fund's monetary system. With more on that, we spoke with anti-war activist Bruce Gagnon. So, in the media, a former acting director of the CIA, who said that he thought there was a real possibility of a war with China. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, Obama has announced a pivot of 60% of U.S. Forces, particularly naval forces, into the Asia-Pacific region. It's important to remember that China imports currently about 80% of their oil to run their economy on ships. The United States moves so much of its Navy into that region, one must wonder if part of the strategy then isn't to intercept and try to control China's importation of oil that would essentially give the U.S. a pointed, loaded gun at China's head, saying, give us the keys to your, or we hold the keys to your economic engine. You're going to do as we say. So, this kind of surrounding has been going on for some time, all the way back to the year 2000. The United States has been moving more and more military into the region, necessitating more airfields, more ports of call, and more barracks. And so in many different places now, Jeju Island, South Korea, a Navy base is being built for U.S. warships, expansion of U.S. operations on Okinawa and Guam.
And they're also turning the Japanese loose, too, right? The Japanese are abrogating Article 9 of the Constitution and essentially an adjunct to the U.S. military.
That's correct, absolutely. So taken together, then, it's a pretty serious move by the U.S., so it's no wonder, then, that China might be a bit defensive and might be trying to expand its own capability in the area. I know because of U.S. missile defense deployments that are key elements in U.S. first strike attack strategy, their job would be to take out Chinese nuclear retaliatory strike after U.S. first strike attack. They've been moving their vulnerable land-based nuclear missiles onto submarines. And of course, then this the politicians in the state of Maine where I live are running around the state saying we need more money for shipbuilding here in Maine for destroyers because China is increasing the size of its military. So it's kind of a circular game.
So, you know, in strategic terms, the rise of the BRICS group as a potential bloc, if not a bloc yet, and the actions of the U.S. towards both China and Russia, which have served really to force a military alliance on Russia and China. Do you see parallels with the Cold War and also perhaps some distinctions?
Yeah, I think that it's very clear that the Russia and China have been making extraordinary steps to create not only economic collaboration, but also military collaboration. And they're now expanding both of those to include other countries. I think BRICS is a huge development that essentially will, over time, assuming that it will go forward the way it's got off to a big start, that it would really be a major competitor to the IMF and the World Bank, the two capitalist institutions that allow these corporations to control many other countries' economies. So this is a huge thing. And I think the determination has been made by the United States and its essentially NATO allies that they've got to move now to counter this. Otherwise, it becomes really reinforced and growing, in a sense, institutionalized, and becomes so big that it overwhelms the U.S. and the European Union's Western capitalist economic program. So, you know, the Russians and the Chinese are trying to create a multipolar world, and they're not going to back down, and they're going to stand up to the U.S. and NATO militarily. I think it could very easily become a war. And we see, you know, places like Ukraine right now that are triggers for a war between the U.S. and NATO and Russia. We see NATO now expanding into Asia Pacific, a place that's never really been before, by signing partnerships with Japan and South Korea, Australia, and other countries. So I think we're in a real serious moment, and all of us in this country have to, in the United States, we have to be doing everything we can to try to cut military spending, try to defend social progress, which will be destroyed because of these high levels of military spending, and try to stop this aggressive U.S.-NATO military program that could lead to world war.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.